Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall and this is episode 124 on crocodilomorph disparity with Dr. Tom Stubbs of the University of Bristol. Now, I've known Tom for quite a while with us, having shared so much time in Bristol, and I really do try to avoid institutional nepotism, but this new publication sounded like too good of a story to miss. As with most macroevolutionary analyses, the research gets very complicated very quickly, and we're talking about phylogenetics and geometric morphometrics. But in the first part of this interview, we're simply going to look at the diversity and the disparity of crocodilomorphs through time. So that's how many different species there were, and how big were the differences between them. This is the fun stuff. Like, did you know that there were herbivorous crocodiles, or even ones that were fully marine? In the second part of this interview, which will be episode 125, we'll be looking at how Tom actually did his study. This is where we'll dig deeper, looking at the methods he used, what his results tell us about rates of evolution, and what the significance of it all was. As always, we'll have pictures of what we'll be talking about on our website, and we'd love to hear from you all on social media. Which is your favourite crocodilomorph? Let us know in the comments section. Anything you can do to share this episode, helping it reach new listeners, is always appreciated. And if this is your first time listening, welcome. Donations also keep the show completely ad-free and are used either for hosting or improving quality. So a big thank you to all those who donate regularly. And as always, we hope you enjoy this episode. So, Dr. Tom Stubbs, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Dave. Nice to be here.
How is Bristol? Is everyone missing me?
Yes, definitely. We talk about it every day. No, I shouldn't be sarcastic. We were here for ages, weren't you? I've been in Bristol for 10 years, which is mad, really. Yeah. My entire 20s, I've been in Bristol. And it was... great to have you in Bristol for that time. You're in Manchester now, right?
I am indeed.
Lovely.
But the audience doesn't need to know about me. We need to know about you. So how did you get into the field of paleontology?
So ever since I can remember, I've had an interest in biodiversity, really. So it goes back to watching like natural history documentaries, things like David Attenborough and those type of old BBC things. And I was always amazed by the diversity of life, when they showed all the colours of all the different animals, then they showed the variety of life in the rainforests and in the oceans. And when I was a kid, that always really fascinated me. I was just amazed at how diverse things can be and how weird and wonderful animals in particular are. And that kind of stemmed into an interest in things from the past. So obviously there's lots of amazing animals around today, but once you start digging into the fossil record, then you see even more amazing animals and plants. So that's when I got interested a little bit more in extinct animals. And again, that stemmed through natural history documentaries and a little bit of Jurassic Park when I was younger. So that got me interested in things like dinosaurs and marine reptiles, pterosaurs. I was always amazed as well how some groups that are still around today had example extinct animals from the past, which are just things that you wouldn't expect. Things like giant penguins and giant flying birds, which are huge condor type things, which are absolutely ginormous compared to modern flying birds. So that all kind of culminated together in this interest in biodiversity and how it kind of rises and falls.
So has that really been the focus of your research to date?
Yeah, so I've worked on quite a lot of different animal groups, but the core of my research is looking at morphology and function across evolutionary trees and across time. So I'm really interested in where you see large amounts of morphological innovation across the tree of life and where you see it at certain time intervals.
So morphological innovation would be like the origin of new forms, effectively.
Yeah, the origins of new forms, whether that's entire elements such as the evolution of wings in birds or paddle-like limbs in marine reptiles, or just the evolution of biodiversity in terms of morphology and functional variation. I don't study so much numerical diversity, so like just counting numbers of species. I study more morphological variation, and that's what's always interested me. I've worked on lots of different groups. So my PhD was about marine reptiles. So most marine reptiles are now extinct, but they're things like ichthyosaurs and plesiosaurs. I've also worked on crocodiles, which is obviously what we're chatting about today, things like dinosaurs and lizards and their relatives. But for me, it's not so much about the animal group. It's more about the questions. It's about identifying either times in the past where there was great amount of innovation or parts of the evolutionary tree where you have great innovation as well.
So can you hear that my cat's come to visit?
Yeah, I could hear her and cat.
Yeah, that isn't going to get on top of your answer, so don't worry about that.
Yeah, that's great.
And he's going to get kicked off the table. Ready for my next question. Go on. Off you get.
That was a nice soothing purr, but yeah, I get he can be distracting for you.
Yeah. Well, it's maybe the audience will enjoy it. Who even knows? So is there anything particularly important about the groups that you've studied and the time periods that they were in that required additional focus, I guess?
So I like to study groups that have quite long geological histories. So I guess you could say that about almost all groups in the fossil record. But one thing that I really like about crocodiles is the fact that they are so ancient, so originating in the Triassic. But also marine reptiles were around for the entire Mesozoic. There are still some marine reptiles around today, like turtles. But yeah, I tend to like groups that transcend a great amount of geological time, because then you can track their rise and fall across major extinction intervals and see how they react, the kind of the ups and downs of Earth's history. So that's what really interests me, that kind of really big time scale. And in terms of groups, like I mentioned before, I'm really interested in lots of different animal groups, but most of my work has been on vertebrates, on tetrapods in particular. But I tend to like big toothy things like marine reptiles and crocodiles and dinosaurs, but also lizards and snakes as well. So yeah, I like being able to study morphology by capturing changes to these anatomies, and things that have nice big jaws and skulls are very interesting for looking at that type of thing.
Guess who came back?
Yeah, who's back?
I think that he is going to be a constant presence in this. So your most recent study that was released just about a week ago now focused on the crocodilomorphs and their diversity. So can we start off by ascertaining what a crocodilomorph actually is and how many of them are alive today?
So yeah, the clade crocodilomorph is quite a mouthful really, but what it generally refers to is crocodile-lion reptiles. So crocodilomorphs are the only surviving crocodile-lion reptiles. They originated in the Triassic, and they're a group of archosaur reptiles. So in terms of living animals, crocodiles are most closely related to birds, which is mad when you think about it. But they are, both groups have a really big evolutionary history and a rich fossil record. So crocodilomorphs and birds can be traced back to the Triassic, to this large reptile clade called the archosaurs. And then down one line you have the crocodile-lion reptiles, and on the other line you have the bird-lion reptiles. So yeah, crocodilomorphs originated in the late Triassic about 230, 240 million years ago. Now that really rich evolutionary history is hidden really by their biodiversity today. So there's actually only 26 species. And although 26 species doesn't sound that bad, it's really, really tiny when you compare it to other equally ancient clades of kind of a similar taxonomic scale. So if you think about birds and the different bird families, so there's over 10,000 species of birds today. So compared to their sister group, their most close living relatives, they're not doing that great in terms of species numbers. And also if you were to compare them to a more distant group like mammals, I think there's about 6,000 mammal species today. And also, if you compare them to things like lizards and snakes, there's about 11,000 lizard and snake species. So, yeah, they have this really rich history going back to the Triassic, but there's only 26 species now.
So in this interview, I think we're going to have some running themes that is going to look at the difference between the number of individuals, the number of species, and then the differences between the species. So we'll get into the terminology for all of that. But you say that there's only 26 species of Crocodilomorph alive today, but how many individuals are there? So are the few species that are alive today, are they doing particularly well, or are they threatened?
So yeah, that's a really interesting point. So what you have in the modern crocodiles or modern crocodilomorphs is a great difference in the how well different species are doing. So of the 26 living species, I think 7 of them are critically endangered. So obviously 7 of them are not doing very well at all. That includes things like the Chinese alligator, the gharial, the slender-snouted crocodile-line reptile, things like the Siamese crocodile. So these are critically endangered, so they're really not doing very well at all. There's also a further 4 species which are vulnerable. So again, you're getting up to 11 different species there, which are quite in trouble, really, in terms of the diversity that they have and the number of species that they have. This contrasts quite a lot to some other crocodile species today. So if you think about things like Nile crocodiles, you'll be familiar with like natural history documentaries where you see them eating wildebeest and zebras as they try and cross the rivers in Africa. And when you look at those, there's actually quite a large number of Nile crocodiles. I wouldn't say there's a large number of individuals when you compare it to things like birds, but when you see a lakeside or a riverside, which is a sea of crocodiles, it would make you think that they're not in trouble at all, but that's just one species of crocodile today. So things like the Nile crocodile, the American alligator as well, these groups are considered at least concern or least risk in terms of the official status of them. So yeah, I think there's a further 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Yeah, there's about 13 crocodile species which are considered least risk or least concern. So about half and half, really. Half are in trouble and half are doing okay.
Okay, and is that linked at all with their ecology, how they are living and what they are specialised to do? So you mentioned the gharial. Gharial, potato. What is it? Gharial?
Oh, I would say gharial, but
gharial.
But I'm not necessarily a kind of authority on that. It might be a potato type thing where either is okay. I tend to say gharial, but I've heard people say gharial before.
Yeah. In the comments, listeners, gharial or gharial, just write down whichever you say. So does any of that have to do with their ecologies? So how they are living and the types of adaptations to the environments that they have? So if we think about the gharial, that is a very specialist, long, super thin snout. Is that got anything to do with why it's threatened? And what different types of ecologies do modern crocodilomorphs have? Are they all doing the same crocodile-y kind of thing?
So yeah, I guess I'll start with the latter point first, because that's probably the easiest thing to cover. So in living crocodiles, in the 26 living species, you see 3 major morphotypes, I'd say. So 3 major morphological forms. There's what you'd describe as the broad-snouted alligator-like ones. So that includes things like the alligator, obviously, the American alligator, but it also includes things like the caimans, so spectacle caimans and broad-snouted caimans. These things have more U-shaped snouts, which are quite broad. You then have the crocodile-like morphotype, where their snouts are more elongate, and they're kind of more like a elongated V-shape. And that includes most crocodiles, so things like the Nile crocodile. And then you also see a very slender snouted form, which is, like you mentioned, very typified by the gharial, where they have a incredibly long snout, and which is very slender. You also see a couple of crocodiles which go towards this morphology. So there's there's things like the Thomistoma, which is which has a long snout, and that though. So within those three different morphologies, there's a clear ecological signal. So particularly in the latter one, in the slender snouted form, those crocodiles are more adapted to eating things like fish and small bodied prey. So you can't take an entire animal in your mouth with these slender jaws. They tend to pick up little prey, so small fish, maybe small mammals and small reptiles. Within both the crocodile snout and the alligator snout, they tend to eat whatever they want, really. So there are subtle differences in the function and biomechanics of those different snout morphologies, but they tend to just eat whatever they want. They're large predators, and they tend to eat large prey, typified again by things like a Nile crocodile chomping on wildebeest. So in terms of which of these morphologies is linked to how vulnerable they are or how well they're doing, I'd say it's a mixed message, really. So in the sample of critically endangered crocodiles, you find things like the gharial, which is long-snouted, but you also find some of the alligators, so the Chinese alligator, and you also find some of the crocodiles, like the Philippine crocodiles and the Siamese crocodiles. So I don't think there's a clear pattern of their morphology and their species numbers, and also the abundance of these different animals. What I imagine it's probably more to do with is their how geographically restricted they are. So a lot of the crocodiles that are in trouble tend to have quite restricted geographic ranges, things like the Philippine crocodile, the Chinese alligator, Siamese crocodile, Cuban crocodile. They're all kind of linked to a very particular place in a very small geographic range. Whereas a lot of the other groups, like the saltwater crocodile and the Nile crocodile, the ones that aren't in trouble, they cover larger ranges in terms of their geography. So I imagine if there was a link or one thing that was linked to their species abundance, then it's probably that. It might be their geography rather than their morphology.
So there are differences in their ecologies, but if we look at it relative to different groups, for instance, the birds again, which are turning to be a very good group to compare the crocodilomorphs to, are their ecologies particularly diverse?
I would say no. So yeah, within crocodiles, they do show variation. So gharials eat fish, larger, broader snouted crocodiles eat whatever they want, but they're all what you'd say semi-aquatic carnivores. So they all exist on shores and in rivers and in wetlands. There's only one marine crocodile, the saltwater crocodile, that goes in the oceans. So in terms of their ecology, of their feeding and of their habitat occupation, they're not particularly diverse today. They're very important for ecosystems as top tier predators, but when you compare them to other large tetrapod groups, things like mammals, birds, again, like you mentioned, they're really not very diverse in terms of ecology. Like if you think of birds, you have penguins, ostriches, hummingbirds, and within mammals, you have anything from a mouse to a whale. The amount of morphological variation there and ecological variation is really huge. Whereas in crocs, that they all exist in these semi-aquatic habitats and they all generally eat fish or other large prey. You don't see any crocs climbing around in the trees. Although, funnily enough, there is actually a few YouTube videos of crocodiles that have ended up in trees. But that's not. Yeah, I think I've seen that before. I can't remember what type of crocodile it was, but I've seen a video of a crocodile in a tree before. And that's one of those things where animals have niches and have ecologies, but occasionally they do something really, really odd. And you don't see many crocodiles running around on land, but there is a species of crocodile that can actually gallop quite well. I think it might be the Cuban crocodile. There was a recent study about this. But again, that kind of galloping around on land is is a side point to their overall ecology, which is these semi-aquatic predators. And again, if you compare it to these other equally ancient groups, then crocodiles don't really do that much today.
Well, today, maybe they did something a bit more different in the past. So let's have a look at some of the crocodilomorphs through time. So if we look back to the very first one in the fossil record, what was it like? And was it very different to the modern crocodilomorphs that we have today?
So that's a very important point. I should say as well, so throughout this chat, we might call them crocodiles, crocodile-line reptiles, crocodilomorphs, but the term crocodile in the literature has a very particular meaning. So that refers only to Crocodilia, which is the larger clade that includes all modern crocodiles and their extinct relatives. But for the sake of us chatting, we can just call all crocodilomorphs crocodiles.
Makes it easier.
Yeah, it's one of those things where if you wrote it in a scientific paper, you'd get told off. But we can call them crocodile-line reptiles or just crocodiles, because most people know what you mean. But yes.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, so the earliest crocodiles or crocodile-line reptiles are from the Triassic, and they're very different to what modern crocodiles are like today. So there's a few examples. There's a Sphenosuchians. Don't worry so much about the name of the grouping, but that's the kind of earliest group of crocodilomorphs, crocodiles, including things like Hesperosuchus and Dromicosuchus. So these were around in the late Triassic, and they were land animals. So that's the main difference. They existed within terrestrial environments, and they lived alongside early dinosaurs, and they had longer legs, so they had more of an upright posture, and they would move around on land as terrestrial predators. And they were generally smaller, so they were maybe only 1 meter long or 1.5 meters long. So they weren't the large, lumbering, semi-aquatic animals that we see today. The earliest crocodiles, or the earliest crocodile-line reptiles, were these fast-moving terrestrial predators. Trying to think of a modern analogy, they were maybe kind of like a dog-like animal, obviously very different, but that type of size and that type of movement around on land. So yeah,
sort of like a Komodo dragon,
maybe even more maneuverable than a Komodo dragon, because they had longer legs. So that's what some people use as a proxy for how well things could kind of bound around on land, how long their legs are. But yeah, I guess a Komodo dragon or kind of a wolf-like posture with long legs and long bodies, and they were kind of bound around on land.
And that sounds terrifying.
Yeah, thankfully they were quite small, so maybe
sounds
the size
less of, terrifying.
Yeah. Can imagine if they were the size of a Nile crocodile, that would be terrifying. One thing we could add as well is that, so when we talk about crocodiles, crocodiles are a type of archosaur, and the earliest crocodiles existed at the time that other crocodile-line reptiles were also doing quite well. So crocodiles and crocodilomorphs are a subgroup of the crocodile-line reptiles. There were also things, their closest relatives, which are not crocodiles, are things like the Rauisuchids. So if anybody watched Walking with Dinosaurs back in the day, the very first episode has something called Postosuchus, which is a large, maybe 2 meter long terrestrial animal. And that is a bit more like a land going big Nile crocodile size thing. So these smaller terrestrial crocodiles evolved alongside their closest relatives, which were these larger terrestrial animals. Some of them were predatory and some of them were also herbivorous, but all of these other groups went extinct during the Triassic. And the only group of crocodile-line reptiles that carried on was the crocodilomorphs, or the crocodiles, as we can shorten that too.
Okay, and so we have our first crocodile now. Have they changed much through their evolution? And if not, why? And that's a question from Laura Jade on Instagram.
So, yeah, so one thing about crocodiles is that they're sometimes called living fossils, which makes people think that they don't change very much, but that's not entirely the case. So we talked about the earliest crocodiles. So the earliest crocodiles were these terrestrial animals wandering around on land alongside the early dinosaurs in the Triassic. But from that, along within the crocodile tree or the crocodilomorph tree, you have these branching events leading to very different ecologies. So in the Jurassic, you have the expansion of marine crocodiles or crocodilomorphs, and these marine animals invaded the oceans and became very diverse. These were known as the Philatasuchians. So these evolved dolphin and whale-like ecologies. Some of them had long snouts and they would feed on fish and they would swim around in the oceans, whereas others had more robust jaws and skulls and they would eat other marine reptiles, really. So kind of a killer whale-like ecology. And that's just one offshoot of the crocodile tree. You also had other terrestrial crocodilomorphs, so other land-dwelling groups. The most diverse and well-studied of these is the Notosuchians. So these originated in the Jurassic, but really took off in the Cretaceous. And they, my favorite crocodile lion reptile group and crocodilomorph group, but they were fully terrestrial. They evolved all sorts of diets. So they were herbivorous, omnivorous. Some of them were large terrestrial carnivores. So kind of 2-meter-long predators running around on land. And they existed from the Cretaceous right through until about 30 million years ago. But along these kind of branching events within the crocodile tree, you do have the appearance of some crocodiles that you would say are very crocodile-y. So you had the appearance of crocodiles which are like the modern forms. These first appeared in the Jurassic, so they weren't actually crocodiles. It's not like you had a Nile crocodile in the Jurassic, but you had animals, you had crocodilomorphs, which had very similar ecologies. So they were semi-aquatic, 2 or 3 meter long predators, and they had similar skull and jaw shapes. So their snout morphologies were similar. So when people talk about crocodiles not changing much through time, it's definitely not the case. But what you do find is that you have crocodilomorphs from the Jurassic, which look superficially like the crocodiles that we have today. That's why sometimes people say that they are living fossils or they haven't changed very much. You actually find the earliest examples of the modern crocodile families in the Cretaceous and early Paleogene. So that's from around about 90 million years onwards. You start seeing the earliest examples of things like early alligators and early crocodiles. And then you see early gharials about 70 million years ago, 60, 70 million years ago. So these modern crocodile families are very ancient, but they have changed through time. Even the modern groups have changed through geological time. But I think the kind of fallacy that they're a living fossil comes from the fact that you've had examples of this modern ecology around for a very long time.
A question we got from I'm Alice on Instagram is, what is one weird croc that evolution saw fit but otherwise seems a bit silly?
That's a great question. Yeah, so this is one of my favourite things about extinct crocodilomorphs, that there are some really, really odd ones. I guess to give one example, there was this extinct alligatoroid, so an extinct crocodile closely related to modern alligators called Murosuchus, and it had a really broad pancake-shaped snout, so it was kind of like a big duck-shaped snout. People sometimes call it like the pancake croc. And it was odd because its snout was very long and very broad, kind of like a really elongated U-shaped. And linked to that, its lower jaw was also very slender. So when you think about that compared to modern crocodiles, it's extremely odd having this really long snout, which is also very flat, and having these gracile, very slender jaws. And this extinct alligator obviously had a very different ecology. It wasn't able to chomp down on things and crush on them. It was probably more of a filter feeder, or well, maybe not filter feeding, maybe like a sieve feeder. So it would maybe accumulate particles of maybe mud and sand in its mouth, and kind of shuffle through the particles in its mouth and pick out little bits of prey. So when you think about that compared to modern crocodiles, it's very odd. And there's obviously no crocodiles around today that have that kind of morphology or that kind of ecology.
Yeah, I'm absolutely blown away, one, by that, and two, by pretty much everything else that you said before. So dolphin crocodiles, whale crocodiles, like there's just so much going on that you just don't think of when you look at the modern ones. Which is your absolute favourite? Which is a question from Dr. JJ Hill on Instagram.
Oh, nice to hear from JJ. So I think I'll... Oh, it's hard to pick because there's so many cool crocodiles, both modern and extinct. I think probably my favourite extinct crocodilomorph would be one called Cymosuchus. So this was a Notosuchian crocodilomorph, so one of those odd terrestrial crocodilomorphs from the Cretaceous. This one was actually known from the very end of the Cretaceous, about 66 million years ago. And it was only about 1 meter long. It was a terrestrial animal with a more upright posture. And it was actually a herbivore. So it had a very, very short snout, almost like a, some people describe it as being pug-faced. So it had like a very small, broad snout, and it had very chunky, robust jaws. And in its jaws, it had these weird teeth, which studies have shown were clearly adapted for eating plants. So that's again very odd compared to modern crocodiles. But there's actually some quite nice reconstructions of this animal because it's known from really wonderful fossils. People have been able to make nice model reconstructions of what it looked like. And then if you search for it, it really is incredible. Or it looks like a mammal, to be honest. It looks almost like a badger type thing, but scaly. And it's got this very, very, very abbreviated snout. And it's actually an outlier in most analyses that I do on crocodile evolution. It's always one of the odd ones out. That's probably my favorite fossil crocodile. My favourite living crocodile is probably the broad-snouted caiman. So that's obviously a type of caiman, and as the name suggests, it has a very broad snout. Also kind of has like a quite odd pug-like face. Its snout is short and broad, and its lower jaw is very, very robust and heavily built as well. And they look, when you look at them, they look like they've got a lot of character. They look kind of cheeky. So I think that's... a modern crocodile that's also a little bit odd, and it's probably my favorite living crocodile.
You mentioned the scales there. Have crocodiles always been scaly? What's their skin like, and has it changed in any of those different groups?
Yeah, so most extinct and modern crocodiles are scaly, so that they're scaly and they have this bony armor. Sometimes called scutes, which cover their body, and that's what gives crocodiles their very robust appearance, and they're very, very it's their armor which helps protect them and makes them so dangerous. There are actually a few some extinct crocodiles which have reduced armor. So the Philatasuchians, the very specialized ones that became adapted for marine existence and wanted to become more hydrodynamic, actually lost some of their armored scutes, which would improve their kind of hydrodynamic efficiency, generate less resistance in the water. So it shows how they were able to adapt in that way. But most land-dwelling crocodiles and lake-dwelling crocodiles have this armor in terms of scutes and scales.
So turning to your study itself, you looked at the fossil record of crocodiles and sought to figure out how they all differed from each other and how and when these differences arose. So what did the study actually look like, you know, day to day? What were you doing and what kinds of data did you use? Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall and Liz Martin Silverstone, with contributions from Tom Fletcher, Vish Venkat, and Elsa Pancharoli. Music was composed by Patrick Kendall-Smith. Paleocast was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on funding from you, the listeners. So, if you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programs, and follow us across social media platforms to get all the latest news. Finally, if you enjoy our podcast, then please explore all of our video content on YouTube and follow our other projects, the Virtual Natural History Museum and the Paleocast Gaming Network.